The next case on our calendar, 08972, Carl Stetter versus RJ Corman Derailment Services. Mr. Dietz.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I represent the petitioners in this case, Carl and Doris Stetter. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of argument time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
The arguments this court just heard in the Kaminsky case presented this court with the alternatives of either declaring revised code 274501 unconstitutional or overruling its own constitutional precedent in Johnson versus BP Chemicals. Neither of these outcomes, however, is required by the statute. Instead, the statute should be construed to preserve the common law cause of action for employer intentional tort. This is the only construction of the statute that is consistent with the Ohio Constitution, that is consistent with the statutory language, and it is consistent with the legislative history surrounding the enactment of House Bill 498. As this court has already heard a fair amount of argument about Johnson, I'm going to abbreviate my comments about that case some, but one thing I would wish to point out is that this court in Johnson was very explicit about the fact that a statute that attempts to narrow the scope of employment intentional torts to situations where the employer had to act with conduct that was both deliberate and intentional creates a cause of action that is simply illusory.
And now, I want to stop you because that word's been used, and convince me that it's illusory. I think we can all think of all sorts of situations to which an employer would expose an employee that would be considered to be deliberate. You know, work in a toxic area where the employer knows there are toxic materials there, the employees could be injured. That's one. There are all sorts of examples. Has this stopped employees from claiming intentional torts? If it's illusory, then I would assume nobody tries to recover under the statute or under a case law.
Well, Your Honor, I suppose that the court in Johnson felt that the standard was just too high for any plaintiffs to bring a cause of action that would be successful. I would stand behind that court's.
But why is that? I mean, the General Assembly has the authority. If we assume, let's take the Section 34 and 35 out of the argument for a minute. The General Assembly has the authority to say, here is a remedy for persons who have certain types of injuries. And here's the standard to be used to determine who recovers under that standard. General Assembly doesn't have the authority to do that. I mean, we're not for us to decide whether they got it wrong. The policy question, is it? Do we say, well, it should have been a little different standard because we don't agree with the standard. You've eliminated 1,000 people or 2,000 people, and you've included maybe only 3,000 people. Is that for us to decide?
Well, Your Honor, I hope that my reference to Section 34 and 35 in your answer doesn't offend you, but
no, you can't offend.
I think that the essence of the Johnson holding was just that. No, without conforming to Section 34 and 35, the General Assembly does not have that authority to enact this kind of statute regarding employees. I believe that was the holding. I believe that was the essence of the plurality reasoning in Brady as well that motivated the syllabus holding in Brady, and that's, you know, the essence of Johnson.
So if the General Assembly had made the test a little easier for the employee to comply with, that would be all right, whatever a little easier means. I mean, your argument is the standard is too high,
well,
that it eliminates too many employees.
Chief Justice Moyer, I don't think that is actually something I could concede either. If Your Honor's question is, well, could the General Assembly have brought it somewhere less than deliberate intent, but somewhere more than where the common law had it, then I would think that under Johnson, no, that couldn't have been done either. Because the reasoning in Johnson, I think, framed in the language of the Constitution itself, is that to enact a statute regarding employees in this way, there must be authorization from either Section 34 or 35.
So the
neither. So, well, go ahead.
So the court can place limitations under Section 34 and 35, but the General Assembly cannot. Certainly, in our Fife test, is it eliminates a number of employees, I would guess, substantially certain to occur. That eliminates some people, doesn't it? So why isn't our Fife test, why doesn't it violate 34?
Well, because Section 34 applies to the General Assembly and not to the Supreme Court. Okay. I'll move on from Johnson a little bit now to speak about the statutory language. But I would, keeping the points in Johnson in mind, I would urge this court to reflect on the fact that the revised code itself in Section 1.47A states that in construing a statute, it is presumed that the legislature intended to comply with the state constitution. Therefore, this court should avoid a construction of revised code 2745.01 that puts it in tension with this court's constitutional holding in Johnson. Regarding the statutory language, unlike the prior version of 2745.01 that was examined in Johnson, this statute actually sets forth two causes of action that are set forth in the disjunctive. The first cause of action is found in the language of 2745A that states an employee can bring a cause of action where the employer acted with intent to injure another. After that, we have the second disjunct, if you will, after the or, that refers to an employee being able to bring an action where the employer acted with the belief that injury was substantially certain to occur. Now, while the definition for substantially certain is found in the statute later in Division B, that first disjunct, intent to injure another, is just left undefined by the statute. And in doing so, the General Assembly left it for this court and this court's development of the common law to supply the definition for intent to injure. And this court has already done so and has supplied a definition of intent to injure. And that is the standard that we find in the Jones precedent and more directly, I think, in the Fife precedent, Fife versus Geno's Inc.
So first time through your brief, it was fascinating, but I wasn't quite sure I followed you. I think I'm following you now. You say you read A up to the or, that's the disjunctive, and for the first part, that the employer committed the tortious act with intent to injure another. That's the Fife test.
Yes, essentially that's right, Your Honor.
And we're done.
Well, Your Honor, my brief goes on to give reasoning for the deliberate intent to injure requirement, but that's not actually a requirement, I should say, but that prong. My explanation for it differs markedly from that offered by respondents and I think by everyone else.
We'll take
else.
Us through that for the Part B.
Well, the Part B, deliberate intent to injure, what happens is after the or, you get the substantially certain. In B, you get the definition for substantially certain, which is deliberate intent to cause an employee to suffer injury. What that language does is essentially refers only to the most egregious types of employer intentional torts, the kind where the employer acts with deliberate intent. And in so doing, creates a statutory cause of action for employer intentional tort that's new in essence, and therefore lies outside of this court's holding in Funk regarding the statute of limitations for intentional torts, and is thus subject to the 4-year statute of limitations in 2305.09.
And to read it otherwise is to, it, as the employers would read it, B is just a total redundancy of A.
Well, no to the first thing you said and yes to the second, I think. I think that the employers are urging this court to read it essentially, yes, as a total redundancy of A and can offer no explanation why this redundancy should exist. However, I would point out to the court that the construction of the deliberate intent prong as giving another 2 years under 230509 is conceptually severable from the construction of the first disjunct, that is, intent to injure, as preserving and codifying the common law, for what that's worth.
This is what you believe the General Assembly intended when they wrote this, or is this the way you think it has to be interpreted in order to retain any validity?
Your Honor, I actually think both. And the reason why I think this is what the General Assembly intended is because the legislative history, and I'd like to refer particularly to the fiscal note for House Bill 498 stated, and I'd like to quote it directly. Since the bill in effect codifies the standard of proof accepted by Ohio's courts following the 1999 ruling, that's a reference to Johnson, if enacted, it appears unlikely to have any noticeable effect on the number of tort actions filed annually. And I would point out to this court that that fiscal note was released by the Legislative Service Commission 6 times, beginning with the bill's introduction and even after the governor signed it on enactment. And in each of the 6 versions of this fiscal note, that language appears verbatim. And I would point out to the court that even aside from the prescience of the analysis, legislators rely on things like the fiscal note to find out what bills, especially one like this one, which I think arguments today have indicated is a little bit tricky language, about what the bill means. And regardless of even what one particular member, even the introducing member of the General Assembly, might have intended, it takes 50 representatives to get it out of the House, is my understanding, and many of those would have referred to this fiscal note and had no reason whatsoever to believe that the statute did, or the bill then, did anything but codify the common law cause of action as it existed.
Does this statute deal with the legal fiction of being outside the scope of your employment when you're actually working and the injury occurs? Does it put it within the scope of employment, or does it preserve that legal fiction?
Your Honor, my instinct in answering that question is to say that it doesn't do anything with regard to that legal fiction, because the statute is enacted pursuant to the General Assembly's authority under Section 34, because under the construction I'm outlining, it is for the health safety benefit of employees. And because it's empowered under 34, it does not need further authorization from Section 35. And therefore, the issue of whether or not it's within the blankenship analysis of being inside the scope, course of employment, I think the words are, isn't actually necessary to uphold the statute under the construction I'm offering.
The second certified question concerns whether or not this statute is unconstitutional because it denies the right to a remedy. We heard some discussion about that during the previous argument. Is there not a remedy for certain classifications of individuals who would be injured in the context, whether within the employment relationship or without the employment relationship?
Well, Your Honor, on that point, I'd have to direct this court to its statement in Gaines versus Preterm of Cleveland, basically that the remedy must be meaningful in order to comply with constitutional requirements. And I would suggest that given the type of intentional tort that would be at issue, that there isn't a meaningful remedy unless an employee can bring a civil cause of action.
And would there be any employee that could or not, in your view?
I don't understand your question. Do you mean any employee in the
sense
that
this statute were held to be constitutional, would any employee in the state of Ohio ever be able to file an intentional tort under this statute?
Under the construction I'm urging? Or under the construction, I'm sorry, but
we have to deal with this statute the way the legislature wrote it, not the way you'd like us to have it considered. So the way it reads now, if we held it to be constitutional, in your view, would any employee ever in the state of Ohio be able to file an intentional tort?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
Then if
they could, insofar as the statute does preserve the common law cause of action,
and
insofar as it abrogates it, I'm sorry.
Well, if such an action could be filed, then there would be a remedy, would there not?
Well, only for those employees, I mean, again, assuming the construction urged by respondents, only for those employees who were victims of these most egregious deliberate intent torts that, as I understand it, this court, even dating back to Talik, has had a hard time even wrapping their mind around what these look like.
So if the class of those individuals who could file such claims before the legislation was greater than those who could file after the legislation, is that a basis for us to declare it unconstitutional in connection with the second certified question?
If Your Honor could repeat the beginning of the question again to make sure I followed it.
All right.
If the scope was greater after the passage...
It's not a trick question.
I know.
All right. What I'm trying to get to is that there is a class of individuals who might be able to file an intentional tort if this statute were held to be constitutional.
Right.
And so the question would be, if there's a class of individuals of a greater number before the statute is enacted,
right,
but lesser number after the statute who are eligible to file or could file such claims, is that a basis for us to say this statute is unconstitutional for violating a right to a remedy?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And tell me why.
And it would be because it violates, even if it does not violate the right to a remedy for every conceivable member of a larger set, it would certainly violate the right to a remedy for a considerable subset of the larger set, and that would be unconstitutional.
And the legislature can't control that number. They don't have any authority to legislate in this area?
Well, Your Honor, the legislature's power to legislate in this area is confined by sections 34 and 35, and insofar
back,
as
we're
it
back to the Constitution, I understand. I think the chief had a question.
Well, I just want to test your response on that. That if we adopted that as a principle of law in this case, that would be a fairly profound principle of law if we applied it consistently, saying the General Assembly, if it decides for whatever reason to adopt legislation that in somehow reduces the number of people who have a cause of action or remedy under a statute, that's unconstitutional. General Assembly doesn't have the authority to do that. You really want to say that?
I don't think it's necessary.
Hey, if you want
to,
I'm not trying to talk you out of it, but that's really a profound statement of law because I think they do that.
Well, I don't think it's necessary for this court to say that to reach either the construction and the subsequent holding that I'm urging, particularly in light of Johnson and in light of sections 34 and 35. I mean, those constitutional provisions and their consistent interpretation by this court provide ample reason to distinguish the conclusion I just gave in response to Justice O'Donnell's question from, you know, whatever perhaps broader scope of torts or civil procedure issues might arise. I don't think we'll, you know.
Thank you, Mr. Dietz, okay. Here's your time. Ms. Durgin.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Peggy Matamo Sturgeon, and I represent R.J. Corman Derailment Services and R.J. Corman Railroad Group in this case. On behalf of these respondents, as well as the several amicus groups that have filed briefs in support of our position, we urge that you do find this statute constitutional and find that the General Assembly has at long last passed a constitutional intentional tort statute. As this court is aware, this case came up in a very different manner than the two that you've heard previous. It came from the federal court with 8 certified questions and virtually no facts other than what's presented in the complaint and the amended answer.
Counsel, the petitioner here urges the same thing, that we find it constitutional and that we make some sense out of paragraph B because paragraph B would appear to be a total redundancy unless you read it the way he suggests, and that is that the first part of A up to the R refers to the Fife test, and from that point on, it's a new statutory remedy with a different statute of limitations.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that that's what petitioner is urging. I don't think that reading of the statute is supported in any way. If you start with the plain language, I think you have to go through sort of a tortured parsing out of it to get to that.
Okay, then what does B mean?
Well, I would admit that it is redundant. I drafted the statute, I don't think I would have drafted it this way, but that does not make it unconstitutional, Your Honor, and that does not enable this court to accept what petitioner has offered when there's virtually no support for that. If you
well,
look at,
does B mean anything other than the first part of A up to the R means?
B means deliberate intent, and I admit that there's a redundancy between intent and deliberate intent, but I think it's clear that in order to get to an intentional tort,
but
under
what would be the difference between intent and deliberate intent?
I don't know, Your Honor.
All right. So under your interpretation, it all means the same thing.
Yes, it is a redundancy.
So
I asked Ms. Keys Walker, what would be an example of a fact scenario in the workplace, in the working environment, that would give rise to an intentional tort under A or B, since they mean the same thing? What would be such a thing?
Well, I understand you asked her about the Brush-Wellman case and agreed that wouldn't, because there was only a...
Well, they knew some people were going to get sick. They just didn't know what was going to be 10 or 12 or...
So if there were a case where they knew that everybody was going to get sick as opposed to 10 or 12 of 100,
so
that
you
might...
can expose people to toxic materials knowing that some of them are going to get desperately sick, may die, but unless 100% of them are going to die, no tort.
I think under the statute that's a conclusion you have to reach.
Boy, that's a fine piece of work, isn't it, on the part of the General Assembly?
Well, I think...
What is left?
What is left in terms of what is an intentional tort?
I mean, does this statute just mean there is no intentional tort?
No, I think...
Other than an employer going out, you know, the ball bat example isn't a very good one, but sending people to absolute certain 100% injury or death, that would be it.
I think that, I'm sure there are other examples, and... millions of factual scenarios can arise, and there are other examples that can, quote unquote, ring the bell of intentional tort.
I'm just asking for one example.
I think that there is a reason that this is a hard cause of action, and that's what this court can't lose sight of. There's a reason that it's difficult to meet the standards set forth in
hard
A and B.
Hard and impossible have two different meanings. I'm asking you, is it an impossible cause
No, I
of
don't
action?
Think it's an impossible tort. The employer with the baseball bat, that takes it out of the realm of impossibility.
But that would be a crime.
Yes, it would.
So is there any universe of tortious, intentional torts in the workplace under this statute that would not be a crime?
Well, what about the idea that, not like the Brush-Wellman case, but that there is a certainty that exposure to a particular chemical will cause harm in everyone who's exposed to it? That would ring the bell of intentional tort under Section A and B.
Okay, I have one final question. The Attorney General's in this case as well. We have a new Attorney General. Has that Attorney General communicated with you any desire to withdraw the position that they've taken in their amicus brief, or are they standing pat on that?
Your Honor, I have spoken to a representative from the Attorney General's office within the weeks leading up to this oral argument. What I was told is they did not wish to appear, but that they were not that we were perfectly willing or able to rely on their brief, and that they are not filing anything different. So
the
my
position
understanding
of
is,
the present Attorney General is the same as Nancy Rogers.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Getting back to this idea that there's a dual cause of action out there for that codifies the common law as it existed and then adds this deliberately intended intentional tort, I think the court has to look back to its language in Van Fossen, because that case interpreted the language of the former 412180, which was almost verbatim the language, Part G of that section was almost verbatim the language that's present in A and B of the present statute. And this court said in Van Fossen that language was a new, more difficult standard for the intent requirement as compared to Jones. So I think you have the statement of the court right there, that this isn't just codifying the common law. It's something more, and it's a more stringent standard. I think also in Talek, you had the court discussing the statute, and in that case, it didn't apply because the facts of Talek took place before the statute was enacted, but the court said that because they took place before the statute was enacted, Fife still applies. The implication from that would be, if it took place after the statute was enacted, that Fife would not still apply and that it would be a more stringent standard. I think you also have to look at this statute in its historical context. I mean, we've talked already today, going back to the 1920s on forward, and if you get into the mid-1980s, the General Assembly passed its first attempt at intentional tort legislation in 412180. Brady Court struck that down. They went back, redrafted it to 274501, but included it as part of tort reform. So the Voinovich decision struck that down as violative of the one subject rule. They came back again, passed it again, and this time the Johnson Court turned it down. Now, my opponent would have you believe that at this point the General Assembly just said, we're done. I believe his quote is, we wave the white flag. We can't pass a constitutional intentional tort statute that's any more restrictive than the common law cause of action. So we're not going to try. And as a matter of fact, we're going to go on and codify the common law in a statute and add an additional cause of action. It simply doesn't make sense in terms of the 25 years that led up to this statute, and it doesn't make sense in terms of the legislative history of this particular statute.
Well, it would make sense in this regard. The General Assembly, on a number of occasions, has attempted to simply codify the common law, product liability being the most noticeable example. They simply came along in the mid-'80s and said, we think we ought to codify this. It was all common law. So it's not unheard of that they might do that.
Certainly.
The operative theory, as I recall, was let's codify it before it gets worse. And so that is one reading. And your opponent's approach is, here's a way to have the words A and B make some sense, and you acknowledge they don't if you read it your way, and a way to find the enactment constitutional, which this court tries to do, find constitutionality. So, and we try to find that the words of the legislature have meaning, that they don't just offer up total redundancies. So I realize you see it as a stretch. Maybe you would acknowledge a creative stretch, but a stretch. But it also has some logic to it, doesn't it?
I would acknowledge that it's a, as you put it, creative stretch. But I don't think that when it's viewed in the context of the legislative intent and what this General Assembly has been doing with intentional tort, products liability cause of action, you didn't have the history that you had with this. And you didn't have the sponsor testimony and the employer groups testifying that this legislation would put Ohio on a more even playing field with its competitors in other states.
Oh, other states don't have intentional tort.
They don't have the potential, not all.
I thought there was a restatement out there that Fife's attempted to follow.
But Ohio has the potential for the additional or double recovery that many states don't. And that if you look at the sponsor testimony where he says he wanted to have intentional actually mean intentional, and the numerous employer groups that spoke to this. And I think I have to address here, my opponent brought up the idea of this fiscal note as being the one piece of legislative history that shows that maybe they wanted to do this. I think that's a misreading of the fiscal note. That fiscal note is speaking only to the burden of proof. If you read it, it's speaking to the burden of proof, and as you'll recall, in 274501, the burden of proof was clear and convincing evidence. And that wasn't just the burden of proof at trial, that was a burden of proof at summary judgment. This statute doesn't mention the burden of proof, but...
Well, if LSC analysis or LBO notes or any of those things had any binding impact, we'd be following those, but we don't. We look at the plain reading of the statute.
Well, and I think the plain reading of the statute doesn't support his interpretation of it. I would argue that you go with the plain reading, but if you do get to the legislative history, it's clear that this General Assembly was not attempting to broaden the intentional tort statute. It was not attempting to codify the common law cause of action. And where that gets us is back to our disagreement as to whether this is constitutional or unconstitutional. Up until that point, we were in agreement that it was constitutional, but differ on the interpretation of it. So when you get back to the idea that you can't interpret it the way petitioner suggests, then you're left with with certified question number 8, which is where he begins his brief, and that is, does it abrogate the common law cause of action? And we would suggest to you that it absolutely does abrogate the common law cause of action.
Is that much like in the context of the product liability legislation that you were discussing with Justice Pfeiffer in response to his questions? Has it totally abrogated it, in your view?
I believe it has. What's left in its place is a statutory cause of action that is that has some elements of it, but it has totally replaced the field of the common law cause of action.
So we no longer have common law intentional tort in Ohio because of the application of 274501.
Correct. And we would suggest to you that it simply wouldn't make sense to have the common law. I mean, I think we can all admit here today that this is for 25 years been an extremely muddy area of the law, and to add a statutory cause of action and a common law cause of action together.
Well, counsel, let me challenge you on that. On product liability, that legislation did not say it was exclusive. It simply said it was codifying what was then in place. And we've had cases since where we have developed further common law in the products area. And likewise, this statute does not say anything about a preemption or exclusively entering into the field.
Correct, Your Honor. It does not explicitly state that. But we would rely on the Bolas decision where the court stated that when the legislature codifies the law on a subject, the statutory provisions are to govern to the exclusion of the prior non-statutory law unless there's a legislative intent otherwise. And I don't think that you have the legislative intent otherwise in this situation.
Ms. Mademoiselle Sturgeon, if I could ask, what is your position with respect to what we have to do, if anything, with Johnson versus BP?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that you have to overrule it. I agree with Ms. Keyes Walker that I think that would be the most direct way to get there, but I don't think you have to overrule it. I think that, first of all, the statute at issue here is distinguishable from that statute. I think that the Johnson court was concerned with the illusory nature of the cause of action, and that in large part dealt with that clear and convincing burden that attached even at summary judgment and on forward that made it a very illusory cause of action. I will admit that this cause of action is difficult, but it is not illusory.
And there still is the right to jury trial and so on.
Yes, there's still the right to jury trial. There's still the right to a remedy. All those, and I see that my time is just up now, but all those other certified questions that are present in the brief with respect to equal protection, right to a jury trial, all of those are not valid constitutional challenges for the reasons stated in our brief. So I don't think you have to overrule Johnson. As I said, I think it would be the more direct route to go, but I think you can find this statute constitutional while still upholding Johnson.
Thank you, Ms. Mademoiselle Sturgeon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dietz, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In the brief time I have, I'd only point out to this court that respondents' attack of the construction of the statute that I offered was at least implicitly, if not more, grounded on the premise that it's unreasonable to think that after 25 years, the General Assembly would take notice and abide by this court's constitutional precedent. And that is just a premise that I do not think this court should countenance. If in fact the court is looking for an explanation as to why 274501 would be enacted, if part, a large part of what it did was simply recognize and preserve the common law. I would just point out again to the court's attention that the unconstitutional statute that was struck down in Johnson did remain on the books until the bill at issue was passed.
What is your view with respect to Ms. Sturgeon's conclusion that in response to certified question number 8, this statute has effectively done away with the common law cause of action? You agree?
I disagree.
Why?
Because...
What's left?
Well, I disagree because the common law cause of action is codified in the intent to injure prong of Division A of the statute.
And so that is the common law cause of action codified in that statute?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I mean, I suppose more precisely what I would say is that that part of Division A essentially defers to the common law, and it uses the language of the common law, intent to injure another to do so. And that, I suppose, under my construction, what would happen is that a court deciding a motion for summary judgment would essentially apply the Fife test, because the statute in the intent to injure language recognizes the common law, and as we stand here, the Fife test is the common law standard for employment.
I think a related question is can this court design a new test as a common law test that would be in conflict with the statutory test?
Well,
as we've done in some areas.
In answer to the precise question, this court could design a common law test that is, let's say, in conflict with Fife, just as a matter of this court's authority. I would not dispute that. I would point out that that then we raise questions of stare decisis with regards to Fife and Jones. And I think that I would point out to this court that, referring to the second prong of the Gallatus test, for instance, the existing common law standard has by no means proved unworkable. And in fact, there was an amicus brief in the Kaminsky case that, so far as I read it, pointed out that abandoning it raised issues of unworkability. I know that the comment to the third restatement that's in final draft notes that courts who have abandoned substantial certainty have had a hard time finding out what to do next. So I think that while this is within that court's power, and I would not dispute that, I would advise the court against such course of action.
Thank you, Mr. Dietz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.